Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Yalta Conference in 1945. If you've been listening recently, you'll know that I've done podcasts on the Casablanca and the Tehran conferences, and so this is obviously the next logical step. And I think one of the things for me that's most interesting about the wartime conferences is the development of Cold War politics even before the conflict has ended. There is a temptation on the part of historians to do this, oh, well, you see, but of course, you know, you start out with the thing that eventually does happen, the Cold War, and you trace back and look at this notion of inevitability. And that's always kind of a red herring, because obviously, you know, nothing is inevitable. And much of what we do as historians would be pretty much invalidated if there were these kinds of notions. There is always the possibility that events may not have unfolded as they do unfold throughout the second half of the Second World War and the beginnings of the Cold War. But then again, that's to go into dangerous kind of counterfactual, slightly Niall Ferguson territory, and we must always endeavour never to go there. Anyway, by 1945, the facts on the ground, if you will, have changed so much since the Allies last met in Tehran that it is becoming increasingly difficult, nigh on impossible, to resist Soviet demands for their own sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. These are not new demands. When Churchill makes his first bit of shuttle diplomacy to Moscow after the invasion of the Soviet Union by the Nazis, one of the conditions for an alliance that Stalin puts forward is that he must have a free hand in Eastern Europe. In Poland, the Molotov-Ribbentrop line must be honoured, and Stalin must be given that portion of Poland at least. He obviously goes on to take an awful lot more. And Stalin, for a man who had suffered catastrophic reversals in 1941, who had supposedly, though this does come from the memoirs of Khrushchev, had suffered this kind of almost breakdown when the extent of Hitler's betrayal becomes clear. He is remarkably confident about his ability to shape a post-war world after the end of the Second World War. This is even, as I said, in 1941. Possibly this is to do with Stalin having a far better grasp of Russia's resources and her ability to fight, and a reasonable understanding of history and Napoleon's last invasion of Russia. Possibly it is to do with Stalin thinking to himself, well, there's no harm in demanding these things from Churchill, because you never know where we're going to be in a few years' time. It could be a combination of the both. Possibly it is kind of Stalin's bravado. Stalin greatly enjoyed throwing people a curveball, seeing how they react, and trying to kind of dominate them conversationally, verbally, particularly testing what people like Churchill were made of. Once again, the problem that the Allies have, and that Stalin knows about, because he has bugged their respective living quarters, the British and American delegations at the Livadia Palace in Yalta in the Crimea, and he's listening to them intently. In fact, it is Beria's son, Beria being Stalin's chief of secret police, Beria's son that does the spying work for him. And he knows that the Allied powers, Churchill and Roosevelt, are speaking kind of at cross purposes. They both want different things. Roosevelt, who dies fairly shortly afterwards, has pushed himself to the point of near exhaustion, and well beyond that point, in fact, to create what he views as his legacy, which would be a United Nations. It's interesting that the efforts to bring America into the League of Nations at the end of World War One resulted really in the complete physical collapse of Woodrow Wilson and his enormous stroke that crippled him and left the rest of his presidency pretty redundant. And in a similar way, Roosevelt puts the last of his life energies really into post-war shuttle diplomacy, or kind of the end of war shuttle diplomacy, to hopefully draw all the major powers into a United Nations that would create this multipolar world, a world where you probably have four main powers: Britain, America, China and Russia, all with their spheres of influence. And this would, in Roosevelt's view, though he never drafted this into a specific doctrine, it's well documented this is basically where he was going, this four-power world would create some kind of balance, because no one power would ever be able to really do too much and behave in too excessive a way if the other three powers were to gang up on them. Churchill was now a man possessed. He needed to get a result over Poland. He needed to make sure that there were free and open elections in Poland, because ultimately the freedom of Poland was the issue that Britain had gone to war over with Germany, ostensibly, whilst there were obviously many, many others. And the wartime sacrifices would have seemed somewhat of a waste of time had the country then be handed over to the Soviet Union. Roosevelt is just less concerned by Poland. Roosevelt views it as being part of the agreement with the Soviets that it would always be in the Soviet sphere of influence, that the Soviets would have their own sway in Poland. And Roosevelt's general view of these spheres of influence was that Britain and America have no business meddling in the Soviets. Also, Roosevelt wants something from the Soviets. There is a distinct possibility that that the war against Japan will drag on and on and on. At this point in time, it's not a given that the atomic bomb will be used. That is, again, as fast-forwarding into history, into the future, and using what we know happens to come back and interpret the 6 months beforehand. Well, there's no understanding at Yalta that there will be the detonation of an atomic bomb over Japan. And even then, there's no understanding that if that were to happen, that would result in Japan collapsing. So the Americans look at the possibility of invading the Japanese home islands with some trepidation. The forecasts for the amount of American soldiers killed dwarfs anything that America has endured during the Pacific War. So getting the Soviets involved and their vast manpower would be absolutely ideal from Roosevelt's point of view. And Roosevelt is keen for the loss of American lives to come to an end. After all, there is an increasing war weariness in America. The war is clearly one. There is a significant lobby that wonders if there's any point continuing. Perhaps an agreement can be reached with Japan now, where Japan accepts some sort of peace treaty, and then disarms itself. So Roosevelt's anxious to prevent this, and yet anxious to not have to bear the entire cost of an invasion and then an occupation of Japan. Later, Harry Truman looks at the possibility of a Soviet advance through Asia with immense foreboding. There is already the realisation that the Soviets have claimed Eastern Europe. And so perhaps one of the motivations for the detonation of the atomic bomb was to make sure that there would be no further Soviet annexations of parts of China or Japan or other Asian countries. And this is something I'll return to when we look at the Potsdam Conference in a few podcasts' time. Stalin was chiefly interested in Poland. Poland was the great prize for the Yalta Conference. And Stalin had, and you may have heard me refer to this before, had something of an obsession with Poland and the Poles. Not only had he persecuted them in enormously disproportionately high numbers compared within the Soviet Union during the purges compared to the actual relative percentages of Poles within Soviet society, but he was obsessed with the fact that Poland had frequently been used as a conduit to invade Russia, be it through Napoleon or via the Germans. And so Poland represented this threat to Russia's security. And as the innately paranoid Stalin was obsessed with such matters, Poland was of the highest priority. And he viewed Poland as a prize as well, one of the tributes of war.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
War, and something that he could extract from the Western allies. The shape of the Cold War world emerges at Yalta as well, with a number of agreements being finalised. But these were things that had always been kind of mooted throughout the last 18 months. So there would now be a division of Germany and a division of Berlin, Berlin sitting within the Soviet zone of influence. The country would be divided into four zones, a British, French, American and Russian, and so would Berlin. There would be there was originally a reluctance on the part of Stalin to grant France an occupation zone. I mean, he was thinking, well, what does the French? Why should the French get anything? They were, next to useless in 1940. They capitulated. Half the nation collaborated. He rather admitted to mention, obviously, that while France was falling, he was allied to Nazi Germany, and that Stalin's war efforts in 1941 were equally questionable. There would be demilitarization of Germany and the process of denazification as well, which is a process which has questionable outcomes and successes. Stalin was very keen on reparations. He believed that given the scale of destruction in Russia, that there should be special reparations to Russia, and was arguing for shipping en masse of large sections of the German population to carry out forced work in Russia. And this indeed does proceed after 1945. Not only does Stalin use the millions of German prisoners of war that the Red Army have captured, but also they seize civilians from Eastern Germany, and they also seize civilians who are German nationals and or ethnic Germans who suddenly find themselves very unpopular in parts of Poland, Romania, Hungary, and other countries that were either occupied or allied to Germany during the war. And the new governments in these countries don't want the trouble of dealing with these ethnic minorities who are roundly despised and hated. And so they are simply shipped off to Russia to very uncertain fates indeed. Stalin agrees that the communist government that's already been installed in Poland, the Lublin government, will be, he says, reorganised in a generally democratic way, i.e. other parties will be allowed into the government. And between 1945 and 49, these parties are gradually, one by one, put out of business or assimilated into the Communist Party or infiltrated by communists, and then their constitution shifted until they become sufficiently communist and then merged with the Communist Party. And so the promises that Stalin gives are, eliminated one by one, not that they were particularly kind of promissory in the first place anyway. The question was mooted about permanently dismembering Germany, perhaps dividing it up into six countries. This is really something that doesn't fly with the Western eyes particularly. And Stalin, in a rather unsuccessful attempt to shift the voting conditions within the new United Nations, which he's agreed to join, on the understanding that Russia will have a veto and sit on the Security Council. He wants all 14 of the Soviet Socialist Republics, so Kazakhstan, Belarus, places like that, to have their own seat, and thus give 14 or 13 additional votes to that which the USSR would have had, and wisely the Western allies turned that one down. There is the question of tracking down fleeing Nazi war criminals, and the new United Nations has a commitment towards doing this. And that's not something that Stalin is overly bothered by, I don't think. But he is, in terms of justice, in inverted commas, particularly animated by something else. He wants all Soviet nationals, be they prisoners of war or Soviets who have fought for the Germans and are now prisoners of the Allies, as the British take custody of a large number of Cossacks in Austria. They are to be sent back to the Soviet Union whether they like it or not. And the same applies for Yugoslavs too. And the British repatriated tens of thousands of Cossacks to their deaths as part of the agreement with Stalin. It's the treatment of the Poles who the British were allied with which is particularly tragic. Churchill said, poor old Chamberlain, he thought he could trust Hitler and he was wrong. But I think that I'm probably right about Stalin. And again, it shows you, by this point in the war, Hitler, Churchill's kind of hubris, if you will, his sense of himself as being a kind of a great man of history and infallible in his judgment. Fortunately, he had Sir Alan Brooke, his chief of Imperial General Staff, at his side for much of the war to steer him away from doing things that were too ludicrous. The Poles who fought for the fought with the British as the Polish Brigade were either sent back to Poland, where they came under immense suspicion and harassment and very often imprisonment from the new Polish regime. A great many of the 200,000 Poles that fought for Britain suddenly found that where they had lived was now had now been annexed by the Soviet Union as the Soviet Union moved eastwards, westwards, I beg your pardon, terrible geography. And this caused, you know, an immense amount of distress that everything they had fought for the last 4 or 5 years had suddenly evaporated over a conversation between Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin. It seems to me particularly that Roosevelt wanted to believe in Stalin too much. He was blinded really by a desire to for Stalin to be the figure that he wanted him to be, for Stalin to cooperate in the way that Roosevelt hoped he would. A week or two, in early March, so a fortnight after the end of the conference, Roosevelt concedes that he's been over-optimistic with Stalin, and Avril Harriman, who was once his ambassador to London, and a very, very close Roosevelt foreign policy insider, says, you know, we must concede that the Soviets have purely totalitarian intentions. Now, this, I think, is an interesting sort of pivotal moment in the evolution of the early Cold War. The period between Yalta and Potsdam, things very rapidly changed within the US administration. The naive optimism that Roosevelt had for Stalin, it doesn't just die when Roosevelt dies in April. It seems to be on the way out a month earlier. And it's possible that in this last month of Roosevelt's life, the fighting in the war is over, all bar the shouting. There is, you know, the war finally, in Europe finally ends on May the 8th. And up until this point, up until the first three or four months of 1945, there's been precious little time or energy to focus on the question of Stalin, because the question of Hitler has just been far much more pressing. The Americans, particularly Roosevelt, have perhaps participated in their own deception about Stalin, wanting it to be true, and desiring it to be true, because the needs of a war against Hitler require an optimism of Stalin. And once the war is clearly won, the thoughts of Stalin's genuineness and Stalin's reliability obviously begin to change. Anyway, I'll be continuing this at some point in the near future on the subject of the Potsdam Conference. There is a new Explaining History title available this week. If you go to www.explaininghistory.com, Julia Routledge's brilliant The Genocidal Century is available to download. You can check it out. It is a history of genocides in the 20th century, looking at five key ones: Armenia, the Jewish Holocaust, the Soviet famines, the Rwandan genocide, and the Cambodian killing fields. And it has an excellent discussion of Raphael Lemkin, who, as we know, was the guy who really created the modern conception of genocide and the modern legal framework by which it can be prosecuted. So check it out. It is a brilliant read. I entirely recommend it, especially if you're doing A-level history. It's well worth getting, because it gives you an excellent big picture of some pretty important 20th century themes. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.